chance to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you doing? Are you hanging in okay? Did you have a good Labor Day weekend? Do you live in part of the world that celebrates or recognizes Labor Day as an event? It sure is one of those odd holidays, odd long weekends, for me anyways, because I don't know. Have you ever been part of a union? Have you ever been part of a organized labor movement? Have you ever been part of organized labor? I have. When I started my career at SaskTel, fresh out of university, I was actually in scope, as they say. So I was part of the union. It was now it's called Uniform, but it used to be Communications and Paper Workers or something like that. And yeah, it was an interesting experience, you know, because we got good paying jobs and very healthy benefits from a company that was, you know, making $100 million in profits every year. So, you know, we were doing something right. Speaking of organizing, today on the show, I'm talking to Chris Young. And Chris Young is one of the organizers behind the Real Bread campaign over in the UK. He's part of an organization called Sustain, who does a number of things around sustainable living and sustainable development, and Chris heads up the Real Bread side of things. And so we have a really good chat. And so I didn't know when I was talking to him, I never made the connection with Labor Day and with organizing, but there you go. It's a timely chat. So that's coming up in a minute. Before then, just, you know, bit of a check-in. Want to make sure you're doing all right and baking up a storm. And for the folks of you in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, Labor Day, where I live in Canada, that's sort of like, that's the end of summer. School starts now. You know, we're back into the autumn activities and that kind of thing. And I wonder for the market bakers out there, it's probably time that the markets start winding down or moving indoors soon or that kind of thing. It's also the wildest time for, you know, the bounty of the harvest in the north. You know, and so it's sort of like the markets are almost over, and yet there's never been more food. So it's an odd time, and so I hope you're just knocking it out of the park this month if you're a market baker and you know, doing a bit of the last hurrah until the end of the market season. Until, you know, if you move indoors, hopefully you're able to do that and keep things going over the winter months. So thinking about you this week, market bakers. And for the folks that are, you know, maybe have a brick and mortar shop, I'm thinking about you too, because, you know, maybe there's opportunities for special orders now from the schools, right? You know, especially with COVID restrictions moving. I'm not going to say COVID being over, because the infections seem to be as mighty as ever, but the restrictions are less. And with folks going back to school, are they going to be sharing lunches again? Are there, and if they are, maybe they're going to be ordering from you. So I hope you get some orders. I hope you're able to talk about safe handling with your clients as they pick up big trays of sweets to share around the office table. You might just want to encourage folks to serve themselves from the big platter that you create and keep a distance while they do it. That's all I'm saying. What else is happening? I had a wonderful Labor Day weekend here in Victoria. For those of you that have been listening to the show for a while, you know that Cindy and I moved out to the West Coast about 2 years now, just coming up on our second anniversary. And coming to a new city, a city with a reputation as being kind of cool to newcomers, even though there's lots of them. It's also a little tough to do that during COVID, as we've experienced, you know, getting here just before all the lockdowns happened. So we haven't had a chance to meet that many people. And some stories that we were telling ourselves was about, like, we haven't had a chance to meet any people here. And that's not true. That's not true at all. And we had that experience this weekend when Cindy found out about a pop-up craft fair up on Haltane Street. And Haltane Street is in a residential area. I'm going to get the neighborhood wrong. It's sort of between Fernwood and Oakland, kind of in there in Victoria. It's about a 50-minute walk from our house. So we walked up there to see what was going on, because these pop-ups are really cool because it's all local artisans, and there's not many of them, maybe 6 or 8 or 10 people. And they're usually doing this as a fundraiser for something. Lately, it's been, you know, the old protesting against old growth logging, or which has turned into protesting against old growth logging and police brutality. But that's a whole other podcast right there. Sometimes it's in support of survivors of residential schools and the Indigenous folks in the area that are still dealing with the fallout from residential schools, that kind of a thing. So there's always a good cause behind it, but it's also really good art and crafts and that kind of thing as well. And so, you know, that ticks both boxes for us. So we got our shoes on, got our backpacks on, and hiked up to Haltane on Saturday. And I just happened to be wearing at random a t-shirt I bought at a farmer's market that's sort of a local design map of Vancouver Island kind of a thing. And the first table I go to is the woman that designs and makes the t-shirts, and she was selling them there. And it was like, oh, hey, great shirt. And we had a good laugh about that and had a chat about how we were seeing her again, because I bought the shirt from her at a farmer's market this summer. And then we went inside, and oh, there, the second table indoors is Owl and Bear Studio, which is a place that Cindy is a huge fan of. It's a young woman who is also a biologist who makes pins and washi tape and interesting designs with all kinds of local flora and fauna, and is always making it for some sort of fundraiser or some sort of promotion for something. So, you know, we've bought a bunch of pins. Cindy has some very nice pins that she wears, and then we've given them as gifts. And I bought a t-shirt in support of Hat and that kind of thing. But we'd never met the actual artist, because all of this is done via, you know, mail order and online ordering and that kind of thing. So we got to meet her and you know, introduced ourselves and had a good visit there, and met another couple of folks that there's a travel mug out of ceramics that I think I'm going to get for Christmas, hopefully, because I gave Cindy the card. And, you know, met a woman who is an art, a painter who also teaches classes. So I think I just signed up for a painting class for the fall, which will be fun. And then the last table in this little shop was the actual folks from Hat. And Hat is the Habitat Acquisition Trust. And these are folks that are trying to buy up land as it comes for sale, or trying to get bequests or that kind of thing, to sort of turn it back to nature, to be sort of nature preserves. This is a beautiful area that we live in, and there's an awful lot of development going on, because if it's beautiful, you should be building buildings on it, right? It's kind of the one theory. And what these folks are trying to do is say, no, we need to preserve more of this habitat for the good of the environment and the good of nature. So the Hat folks were there. So, you know, we bought a couple of stickers, but then they were actually selling hats, like ball caps, with their logo on it. And one fit Cindy very, very well. So she bought a hat that says Hat on it. And so we had a very good laugh about Cindy's hat that she'll be wearing around town now. And I think that is absolutely hilarious. So we were there, you know, for probably about 20 minutes of buying, but an hour of visiting. And that was the first time we've experienced that in Victoria, that I would say that, you know, we ran into multiple people who we knew or kind of recognized us and that kind of thing. So look at us walking about town, meeting the people. It's coming, slow but sure. So that made us very, very happy. All right, this part isn't an ad, but it is a request. It's an ask, put it that way. You know, one of the things that will really help this show out and help me bring more conversations to you and more Baker Talk to you is if we can get more people to listen to the show. You know, it's as simple as that. There's two ways of doing that, really. One would be, you know, talk about the show on social media. Like, I'm at Mad Baker on Instagram, and if there's a show that you like, you might want to post about it and tag me in. I'm also like MadBaker66 on Twitter, that kind of a thing. Another way of doing it that has a lasting impact over the long term is to leave a review for the show. If you listen to this on Apple Podcasts, just going to Apple Podcasts and leaving a review of the show, both give it like a star rating or say a couple nice words about it, that really helps. It feeds the algorithm, you know, like our overlords, the algorithms. Sad but true, feeding the algorithm really helps. And so no matter how you're listening to the show, they'll have a review mechanism. And if you want to give it a review, that would be extremely helpful, because then I go up the charts. Even now, as we speak, this show is one of the top 20 food shows in Holland. True. I kid you not, according to one thing I saw anyways. So I'm like, what if we were like one of the top 15 food shows in Holland? That would be fantastic. Or you know, in the top 50 in France, or what if we were one of the top 75 food shows in New Mexico or Mexico, the old or new? That'd be pretty cool. So if you like the show and you're just boring all your friends, raving about the show, telling them about it on, you know, Instagram and TikTok and Facebook and all of those things, maybe take a break and leave a review on Apple Podcasts instead, or wherever you get this podcast. That'd be helpful. So thanks a bunch. All right, the main beast, Chris Young. Okay, so Chris Young. Chris is the coordinator of the Real Bread campaign, and he's been doing this since like 2009. So he's been, the campaign's been around, and he's been part of it for a very long time now. And the Real Bread campaign is awesome. It's a way for bakers around the globe, but especially in the UK, to stand up for real bread made without preservatives, made without additives, and proper labeling of food, and saying like what we're making is different than the stuff that's, you know, par baked and heavily preserved and stuck on the shelves for weeks at a time at the supermarket. And so, you know, he's been one of the leaders of this campaign. They come up with interesting ways to promote real bread around the world. And this month is one of their flagship months because it's Sourdough September. Sourdough September is a way to promote the baking of sourdough bread, whether it's at home or going to a bakery that's making real sourdoughs. I've wanted to talk to Chris for years, but I really wanted to make sure when I heard about Sourdough September coming up that we talked to him right away. So reached out. We had this chat last week, posting it up as soon as I could. So we still have a lot of September to promote sourdough. All right. Here's the talk with Chris Young, the coordinator of the Real Bread campaign based out of London. Let's go. When I realized that you've been involved with the campaigns almost since the very beginning, I was curious sort of how you got involved and how it got started.
So the Real Bread campaign came out of really the seeds of it were a baker called Andrew Whitley, who had been, he'd actually worked for the BBC World Service back in the 70s.
And oh, wow.
In the mid 70s, I think it was 76, he quit his job and decided to move from London up to the Lake District in England, which is sort of northern England, out in a little village in the middle of nowhere, I think is fair to say. And he took over what was the village bakery in a place called Malmesbury, and he decided to convert it into an organic bakery, and people thought he was crazy. Not a huge market for, it was a bakery. I'm not sure if it was doing particularly well on anyway. And, you know, the market for organic food in the 70s was a very different market than it is today. Anyway, he moved up there and made a go of it, made it successful. And in about 1990, I think it was, he went on a trip to Russia. He used to work for the Russian service of the BBC. And so he went there. And during that visit, someone gave him some sourdough starter. And that sort of led him down the sourdough path. And anyway, skip forward to 2002, he sold the business, and he had time to reflect and tried to put together some of what he'd learned as a real bread baker, latterly a sourdough real bread baker, as a baking book, but also just sort of the ethos behind what he was doing, why he was doing it, and what he saw was going wrong with Britain's loaf life, and the things that he thought that people could do to make a difference, and saw that people were doing to make things better. And people took this book, it's called Bread Matters, came out in 2005, took it up not only as a manual, but also as a manifesto. And people were coming to him and saying, oh, I didn't know that they were doing that to my daily loaf. And how can we get involved with this movement? Oh, I found a like-minded baker in some cases. And he sort of was, well, I'm just a baker and I teach baking. I'm not a campaigner. I'm not an organizer in that sort of way. But he was friends with people at the charity Sustain,
okay,
which is a UK food and farming charity. They said bread, yes, staff of life, how many percent, 90-odd percent of people buy it every week, and 70-odd percent eat it every day, and yet what we're being sold is not as good as it could be. Yeah, we'll do a campaign around that, we'll start. So 2008-2009 started Wheels in Motion, and at the end of 2009, November 2009, Andrew and Sustain launched the Real Bread campaign. That's how it started, and I got involved in the Real Bread campaign Real Bread campaign launched in November 2008. I got involved in early 2009. It just so happened that at the end of 2008, I went on a bread making course just out of interest, and the guy teaching it was this Andrew Whitley. And at the end of it, said, well, I've got a bit of communication experience. Is there anything I can do with, to help you with your cause? And he said, well, next week I'm going up to London to launch this thing called the Real Bread campaign. So that was, I found out about it a week before it officially launched. And so I got in touch with Sustain and said, hello, here's me. Do you need any help? And they said, well, we've got volunteers, we've got no money, so thanks. But, the seats are filled, basically. But I signed up to the mailing list, and a few months later, a volunteer vacancy came along, and I went along in my lunch break. I was at the time working in PR. I wasn't particularly enjoying it, so I went along in my lunch break, and they said, well, okay, yeah, if you want to volunteer, you can. So I went back from this meeting and quit my job to start volunteering, thinking that I would do that volunteering as something out of interest and something useful while I was looking for my next job, except that this was my next job, and I've been there ever since.
Wow. Wow. That's what a story. That's so cool. Just that, talk about right place at the right time.
Absolutely.
You happen to take a course, and you happen to take it from the person that's about to really kick it off. That's so cool.
And I mean, going on this course, and it was my wife had spotted it. It's a place called Schumacher College in southwestern England. And she spotted it while she was looking at another course and said, oh, you might be interested. You like cooking. I wasn't ever a particular breadhead, but cooking. Why not go on that? It's a weekend retreat, retreat. You could go away and think about what you want to do with your life, and you never know. You might meet someone that leads into your next job. And I went, whatever.
Yeah. Well,
she was right, as she often is.
It's like went on a baking course, quit my job. That's a story for a movie right there.
And my vocation.
Well, and the fact that you've been hard at it for 12 years is pretty wild too. Like this wasn't, sounds like it hooked you really good.
I just love it. I love what we're trying to achieve. I, I, I can see the problems, and I believe in what we're doing. And I'm just working with such great people. In the charity Sustain, a lovely bunch of people, great bunch of people, very passionate about what they do, very knowledgeable, and you know, working on things like hospital food and children's food, around food poverty, to try and sort of shift things away from food banks and saying, well, what are the root causes of poverty? Because the solution to poverty isn't cheaper food. You know, that's just a sticking plaster approach. That's, you know, yeah, making everything cheaper is just a, you know, not going to work in the long term. But also all these sort of good things, but also the bakers, just as you have done, you know, being in touch with so many fantastic people in the baking world. It's yeah, people who are just absolutely passionate about what they do.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, you know, and I learned about you when I owned my bakery, right? Back, or like we owned a bakery, a retail bakery back in 2011. And, mm-hmm, and it was around that time that I kind of realized that you existed and what you were doing. And this week I spent more time digging into Sustain as an organization. And I have to say, like, I was kind of intimidated. But because just like you said, they really look at it from, okay, what are some root causes here? I'm going to cast the net wide enough to try and look at all, you know, the food issues at a very macro level. And then, okay, now what specifically can we do to fix things and to improve things? And it's when you, I don't know, for me anyways, when I look, it's just how broad an area that they were trying to affect. It was like, wow, like this is a really big deal for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And that's the thing, it is, obviously food touches upon everyone's life. Yeah. And we all eat it. And unfortunately, far too many people can't afford to eat food that's as good for us and for communities and for the planet as it should be. And so there are different people working on projects in alliance with, I mean, the Sustain is an alliance. So we work with about 100 different organizations. So it's not, yeah, just our off small office of 20 odd people sort of trying to solve the problems in Britain. It's we kind of tend to join the dots between the other people, you know, the other larger organizations that are working on specific areas where there might not necessarily be this alignment, but not necessarily overlap. We try and help create overlap, or at least bridges between organizations. Yeah. And where that doesn't quite work, what we do is say, right, as is the case with bread, we'll sit in the middle and create our own project, because you've got Soil Association working on the organic side of things, and you've got other people working on different things that are all kind of related to and around bread, and bread can, mm-hmm, fall into. But we're saying, no, we're going to work specifically on bread. So,
yeah. Well, and so then,
in numbers.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And so what is the main goal of the Real Bread campaign then, to like if everybody's sort of hitting around the edges, what's the main outcome that you're hoping for?
Yes, the Real Bread campaign, we define real bread as made without additives, which, right, sounds really simple, because it is, but that rules out something like 90 something percent, depending on whose figures you believe, 90 odd percent of everything that is sold as bread in the UK. And from that simple and universally accessible starting point, I mean, you know, my four-year-old bakes bread with me. He can make a loaf of bread with flour, water and salt, or flour, water, yeast and salt. From that very simple starting point, we find and share ways of making bread for us, better for us, better for our communities and better for the planet is our mission statement. And so over the 12 years, we've been looking at various different ways that we might do that. And different people have different areas of interest and different focuses. And so at different times, it'll be, for example, we're just Sourdough September. That's focusing on sourdough. There is a growing body of evidence to suggest that as well as tasting delicious, using a sourdough starter can make changes to the dough that when it's baked into bread, actually beneficial. So reducing glycemic index, one study has found. There are changes to the gluten structure that take place, which which may reduce the levels of certain parts of the gluten, the gliadin proteins, that that trigger the celiac response. It's not saying that people with celiac disease can eat, you know, wheat-based sourdough, but there are sort of other interesting things that are saying, are there people with allergic responses that with that reduction, or at least intolerances, if that reduction takes place, that they can do it. And anecdotally, certainly, I personally, and certainly through bakers in our network, have come across so many people who've said, I can't eat a loaf of it, you know, a supermarket loaf, or even a yeasted bread from an independent bakery. And I've now found that actually I can eat genuine sourdough bread. So that's just one of the ways. But we're also looking at particularly focused on community. So the role that a small independent real bread bakery can play in the local community,
right,
helping to keep the high street alive and to keep money circulating in the local economy. So it's the health of the community. But we, you know, go right back to the grain that's grown, looking at that. You know, are there different grains that can be grown that actually are intrinsically nutritionally better in the first place? There's been such a race, well, not a race, but there's been over the years just such a focus on high yielding wheats,
yeah,
you know, more tons per hectare or per acre of wheat that is very high in strong gluten that will make big white fluffy loaves,
right,
and taking the eye off the ball when it comes to the nutritional value and also flavor. And now people are saying, hang on a second, we're looking through the gene banks around the world and we're finding seeds of these grains which were kind of dismissed because they're either low yield or whatever the reasons were. These make great tasting breads, and they grow really well actually in certain conditions. That means we don't then have to spray, you know, agrochemicals all over the fields and kill everything else, and then loads of fertilizer, which is unsustainable in the long term as well, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that's really the appeal on a personal level for me, because I'm right with you. One of my kind of call it a fundamental assertion is that towns that have local bakeries are happier, healthier, more vibrant towns, right? And that whole, you know, industrial model of, you know, it would be much more efficient if we grew one type of wheat, if everybody grew one type of wheat and sold it to the factory for the cheapest amount of money, and then did a highly processed, you know, food product on the outside of that, that it's more efficient, but you're losing, you know, nutrition, you're losing community, you're losing local money, local economy, all of that stuff in the name of, you know, the factory making all the money. And so, I've always felt a kinship with what you're doing, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, across the food system, that's true, isn't it? There's this sort of mission to make everything cheap and efficient, or at least cheap at the till. And lots of marketing to go, hey, isn't this great for reasons X, Y, and Z, which might be might be a bit spurious to say the least, and say, oh, look, isn't this cheap? But then I sort of see it as marketing sleight of hand of, well, what are the true costs of a supposedly cheap loaf?
Right.
Where is that price being paid if it's not at the till? Where is it being played, and what's being screwed over to get to that cheap point? Because still the shareholders of those companies are making a lot of money.
Right. Yeah.
So what's being lost, and is it people's wages that are being cut down to minimum and employment standards that are not necessarily as good as they could be? Are people being paid, you know, a fair wage, a living wage?
Yeah.
Are the farmers being paid properly?
Exactly.
Are the millers being paid properly? And that's our jobs being just basically taken out of the system by throwing everything in supermarkets, where increasingly people don't even work in supermarkets anymore. You just walk in with your phone and scan something, or something just follows you around with a tracking eye, and you don't even have to have store staff anymore. But then also in terms of the environment, you know, what's being done there? What's getting a good kicking? Is it animals? Is it the soil? Is it both?
Right, Right. Yeah.
So, and then, the health costs keep on seeing reports of ultra processed foods and the potential health costs of that, of, you know, what are they doing to our human health?
Yeah.
And who's picking up the bill for the health care for all of that individually?
Right.
In the UK, we're all taxpayers paying into our national health service, and we're paying an awful lot of money for diet-related ill health.
Right, right. And just, so back to like what we were talking about with sustain, let's start fixing things at the source, or at the front end of the that chain, you know, with just like, what are you eating and who are you buying from? Where's your shift where the money's going, for sure. And so with the campaign running for 12 or 13 years now, how's it changed over time?
Sadly, there's a lot of it hasn't changed. One of the, some of the key things that we were trying to, on the actual campaigning front, trying to do back in 2008, 2009, was around food labeling. In the UK, you have to put full ingredient labeling on a product that's sold wrapped, so a wrapped sliced supermarket loaf. You have to put the full ingredient labeling on. But for an unwrapped loaf, you don't. So you walk into, say, a supermarket, and you see something, you know, a baguette or ciabatta or whatever that looks, you know, they're pumping all the smell to the front of the store and it smells amazing. You think, oh, fresh bread. And you get to the back and you think, that looks the part. And it's in wicker baskets these days, on wooden shelves in a lot of cases. And it's all sort of, you know, painting a picture there. And there's no ingredient list. They've got a list of allergens, but not ingredients. And, you know, quite forgiven for thinking, if, you know, well, that's the same as I get from whether it's a conscious sort of process or it's, you know, just beneath the surface, that's what I can get from a local independent bakery. You know, I'm here now and this is cheap, you know, it's convenient and it's cheap. Why bother going to the local baker when I can get the same thing from here? And what's not presented to people is actually that thing is not necessarily the same product. You know, not all loaves are created equal. That may have been made with a whole bunch of additives. You may be kept, you know, in pretty much the same sort of thing that you would get in a wrapped sliced loaf. But there's this neat trick that supermarkets perform for their so-called premium products is charging you an extra, you know, pennies or cents on something that means you're paying a premium over the rest of their standard range, and at the same time they're still undercutting the small independent bakers. So doing the same two things at once there, they're making an extra buck. And still managing to price it in a way that people think, oh, it's cheaper, I'll go here. So we've been campaigning for that full labelling, and there are certain additives that if people deem them to be processing aids, is the term, they don't even have to appear on the label at all where there is a label. So we've been campaigning for the labelling so people know what they're getting. So, you know, we're not telling people what to buy and what to choose, we're just saying provide some more information so people have a better chance to make a better formed in choice. And then there are terms that are bandied around by marketers all over the place. Things as simple as freshly baked, fresh today, baked in store. I would think, and I'd say that most people would think that means that there's someone out the back, you know, with a bag of, you know, sacks of flour and some yeast and a bucket of water and an oven and making all of that stuff fresh from scratch today. But no, you know, you can have something that is made overseas, long time ago in a factory far, far away, and then part baked and frozen or chilled and then shipped to the store and then just rebaked in what we call loaf tanning salons at a later date. You know, so this is not baked, this is rebaked, and yet they're selling it as fresh bread. Whole grain, we all know the healthy halo of whole grain. We're all being told to eat more whole grain foods. And in the UK, the term whole meal is protected. You're going to use the word whole meal. It has to be 100% of the flour. It has to be unrefined flour. Whole grain, all bets are off. Call what you like whole grain. So there they are again, typically charging a premium because this is healthy stuff, healthier stuff.
Right.
You know, this whole grain loaf. And, you know, there's like 6% wholemeal flour in it. And sourdough is another one that isn't protected. And artisan and craft and all of these words. are being used by these, you know, the 3. Whatever billion pounds, you know, industrial load fabricator industry over here, and the supermarkets, to convince people to part with their money. And we think that, you know, in a lot of cases, they're disingenuous or even downright misleading in the way they're doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You know, and it's the same. It's the same in Canada for sure. You know, and I never considered the fact that the unwrapped loaves don't need labels, and that now my mind's racing because it's been so long since I've been to a supermarket bakery. But you're right. You know, like, yeah. And I'm pretty sure it's the same thing here. Like even at, you know, the superstore or whatever that, if you're buying the buns or the baguettes or that kind of thing, that there's no label on it at all. Mm. Because at our bakery, we used to here's what's in our bread. And it's a much, much smaller ingredient list than what you're going to find in the Dempster's healthy whole grain, you know. And you're right about the premium, because that, the bag of Dempster's healthy whole grain is going to be probably the same as what I was charging at the bakery or approaching the same price.
Right. Yeah.
And there's 34 ingredients in there, and I don't know what any of them are.
So that hasn't changed, but there are other things that have. There's another category of food. So you've got the unwrapped or unpackaged, right. You've got the packaged, and then in between them, I don't know what it's called over your side of the pond, but over here it's pre-packed for direct sale. So that's a bakery that says that, or a food producer that packs something and then sells it elsewhere, but at one of its own sites. So
okay,
that could be a supermarket is producing it in a central bakery and shipping it to its stores. Or it could be a small independent bakery selling it at its farmer's market stall. So, you know, it covers a very wide range of types of producer. But in that case, you don't have to have a label on that either.
Oh, okay.
And that is actually just about to change this October in the UK. We've been campaigning for that since 2009, and sadly, it took someone dying from eating it was actually Pret a Manger baguette that had sesame in which wasn't on the label because there wasn't an ingredients list, and someone died.
Yeah.
Severe allergy, anaphylactic shock, and died from that. Natasha and Edmund Laperouse and her family then campaigned very, very vocally and were very successful in pushing that one over the line of getting full labeling now on the pre-packed direct sale. But still, the unpacked stuff hasn't been caught in that. You know, you still don't have to even put a sign on the shelf or a poster near the shelf, which is crazy.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons people want or need to make those choices, you know, it's not all about allergen labeling for us. It's about, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Just
let's be honest about what's in what we're eating. Yeah.
But that's changed. And, you know, I'm talking of Pret a Manger, managed to get Pret's wrist slapped for using the word natural. We sort of, you know, Pret a Manger is a sort of a small chain based mainly around London, although I think they've gone into about five other countries overseas. I think they had a store in New York and Hong Kong or somewhere. Anyway, they're not huge, but they're not tiny either. And they talk a good game, and they, you know, from the word go, they've always been doing things a little bit differently than some of their competitors. In some cases, you know, we saw them as doing things better. And so I approached them and said, you know, it would be great if we could say, you know, can you tell us about some of your products? It'd be great if we could actually go out there and say to people, hey, Pret's doing this really well. How about you? You know, this is disproving this idea of, well, we can't do X, Y, Z at scale. Saying, well, you know, how about this? So I approached them, and it turned out that a lot of their stuff is just full of additives. And I said, hang on a second, you've got all of these additives, and yet you're using your logo has the word natural in it. You know, what's that about? Well, no. And we had a backwards and forwards for about 18 months. And eventually I took it to Trading Standards Authority and our Advertising Standards Authority over here. And slow moving wheels, it took something like 4 years to go through. But in the end, you know, the consumer protection bodies went, hang on a second, no, that's not anyone's reasonable definition of natural food is something that's full of additives. So they had to take it out. So Well, that was kind of a very small win because it was only based on one company. But so there have been a few changes. And the big thing that's changed really is just not directly attributable to the Real Bread campaign with a big C, but the whole movement, the bakers out there, the increasing numbers of bakers out there, sort of helping people understand, sharing that knowledge and love of real bread and you know, in some cases, particularly sourdough real bread, and people getting a better idea of the differences between, you know, what you get in the supermarket typically and what you can get from a small independent baker. And this sort of growing love for sourdough, as the world seems to have seen during the pandemic.
Right.
You know, that would not have happened 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And certainly when we were talking to bakers, you know, bigger companies 10, 12 years ago, and they said, well, we haven't got time or space to do sourdough. You know, we can't do that. You know, at scale, we can't do that. And now they're jumping on the bandwagon because they've seen that there's money to be made. And they're still desperately trying to find a way of cutting corners and selling stuff as sourdough, but not actually going through the boring process of having to train bakers and actually learn how to make sourdough bread. They're chucking a bunch of yeast in a concentrate or some powders, you know, dried sourdough powder, and it's what we call sourfoe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I get a magazine in Canada here, like a baking industry mag, and it's the cycle happens like every couple of years. You'll see an issue that says hot trend coming up, and in this case it is sourdough bread, and then within a couple issues you've got like the big guys, whether it's Parados or Don Foods or whoever, is like, okay, we have a product that if you put this in your dough, you can, you can say it's a sourdough, it's authentic sourdough flavor, you know, and that kind of thing. And it's the cycle repeats, and they can do it. I saw it with cupcakes. I saw it with whatever, but at no point is it like, here's how we're going to make the, here's how to train your crew to make the actual product. It's here's the mix in that you can put in to say it, you know.
I actually just saw a tweet, I think it's from India, just earlier today, and it's I've got it in front of me here. It says, allure your customers with the rustic aroma of a freshly baked authentic sourdough bread that is reminiscent of a traditional Swiss bakery. Made using X, a unique concentrated premix composed of natural dehydrated sourdough. And then you follow the recipe and you have to chuck a load of baker's yeast to make it work. It's like, no, that's not sourdough bread. You know, that's fundamentally different product.
Well, there was a documentary about that I just saw in the spring where they were contrasting a small bakery in Germany which to my, you know, compared to some, to myself even, was a pretty large family run bakery, to the big industrial guys. And and just the this idea that, well, if I put this product in my mixer, I'm now making authentic Italian ciabattas, or if I put a different product in, I'm making, you know, authentic Swiss sourdough bread. And it's like, what I like about what you're doing and with what the bakers that are part of the campaign are doing is saying, like, no, I'm going to celebrate what I'm doing in my small bakery in Scotland, and I'm going to celebrate what I'm doing in my small bakery in the middle of England, and so on and so on. And we agree on some principles, and now we're making our unique products, you know, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing that when I see my friend Rosie in Scotland, I'm having something that's different than if I'm seeing Joe in Ireland, or if I'm having one of your loaves, right? You know? Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that because I stumbled across one of your publications today about I'll get you to describe it, but you were helping bakeries reduce wasted product, and sort of came up with a paper for them to help get their head around leftovers, you know, really as being the thing. So, at our bakery, you know, we planned for as few leftovers as possible and then had a charity program to take care of the surplus, and all right. But I really liked what you were doing was trying to, in my mind, to con- convince bakers that it was okay to sell out from time to time.
And yeah, yeah. I mean, that was so that was a project kind of did a few years ago called No Loaf Loss.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
As you say that as you were doing and do the fantastic that bakers that have got leftovers at the end of the day are passing those on to food banks and basically making sure that those loaves get ate by somebody along the line. And in some cases, people who might struggle to afford really great bread, which is great. The whole issue of food banks is another thing of that kind of sticking plaster approach, but it is still, it's a good thing being done while we're finding, you know, while people are working on the root causes of why people have to go to food banks.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, I started then sort of going backwards from that and saying, well, why have you got leftover loaves at the end? Okay, sometimes, yes, a bakery will have a number of loaves for whatever reasons, but how can we reduce, you know, how can we help bakeries reduce the number of loaves and the frequency with which those leftovers are there? You know, it's not just sort of preventing food waste, it's about preventing that surplus in the first place. And I mean, happily, I have to say, during the course of putting this thing together, I found that typically small independent bakeries have very, very, very low surplus in the first place.
Right.
And there are certainly a number of them that, you know, when I was saying, how do you prevent it? It's like, I don't know. We just don't have, or rather, what do you do with your surplus? It's like, well, we don't, you know, we might have once in a blue moon, a couple of loads here and then, you know, the cleaner gets it or, you know, one of the staff takes it home sort of thing. And it is that lower problem that they can't build into systems like food banks because there just isn't enough to kind of make it worth anyone collecting or taking to a farm for pigs or whatever, lucky pigs. But yeah, so it's going back to some things of what you can do is, I spoke to some people, it's like, do you check the weather forecast before, you know, ahead of the weekend while you're planning your production? It's like, no, just kind of bakeries typically will have seasonal sort of, well, we sell more of this at this time of year and less of that at that time of year. There was a bit of that, but even some bakeries didn't even really quite do that. It was just a bit of a, well, didn't sell so much of that yesterday, maybe won't make so much next week, and it was a bit not fully thought through as maybe it could have been. And at the other extreme, there are bakeries that absolutely keep spreadsheets of everything they've ever done, and they can see from day to day and time to day what sells when and say, well, actually, there's no point in baking X on a Tuesday morning, maybe someone Tuesday afternoon, or if we do, you know, more than one bake in a day, or, you know, in June, you don't sell any of this, and in July. So going into that real detail of looking at trends across times of day, days of week and months of the year, and then, yes, doing the things in between that of saying, well, okay, we've got this idea that we're going to bake, you know, how many hundred burger buns on a Friday night for Saturday morning because everyone's going to have a barbecue. Have you actually checked the weather forecast to see if it's worth doing that? Is it going to be peeing it down with rain and you're suddenly going to have all these burger buns that you're not going to use? So it was things like that about just, you know, having a bit of planning ahead. And keeping an eye on stock and not stubbornly sticking to something because that's where you've done it. And no, we've just thrown away a load again. Just sort of going, what are people buying and what do we need more of and what do we need less of? And then, as you said, there's that sort of mentality of that, and I can understand it, you know, as an outsider, because I'm not a professional baker, sort of understand it as that worry that if a customer comes in or a shopper comes in and sees your shelves are empty, that might be your one or your last or your only chance with that shopper. Right. And they might say, "Ah, crikey, this is a bit rubbish. You haven't got what I want. I'm going to the other bakery or to the supermarket next time because I don't want to travel all this way and find out you're out of stock." But, you know, helping bakeries sort of have the confidence to say, well, no, spin that round as a good thing. You know, we're doing... You know, you market in a way saying we're not a rubbish bakery because we've run out. We're a good bakery because we've run out. That means we're not throwing extra away. You know, we're helping solve that problem, not be part of that problem. And then go on to sort of ideas again with marketing about, you know, what do you sell instead? So, well, if you haven't tried that, how about trying this instead? You know, we've got none of that, but we've got lots of this. Try that. Right. and also then promoting the ideas of things like customers ordering in advance, which
exactly
guarantees the customer is going to have what they want when they want it, but and also is good for the bakery because it helps you, you know, work your production levels.
To me, that's an example of sort of the transition, I guess, because on the one hand, you've got the work that you do for labeling and what I'd call like consumer education. And on the other hand, at the other extreme, sort of keeping bakers connected, do the real bread pledge, let's get involved in September, that kind of a thing. And then here's sort of a almost a transitional thing. It's like you've made the pledge. Now here's some things that you can do to help them keep sustainable, keep more, you know, put the pledge into practice, if you will.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that we really want is we want everyone to have the chance to choose real bread, ideally, you know, within either they bake themselves at home. So there's part of it is sharing recipes and, you know, encouraging people to get baking.
True.
And say,
yeah,
you can do it. You know, there is a way to fit this into your day and the skill, get those, you know, basic skills to make a basic loaf. It is actually quite easy. Yes, artisan bakers, huge levels of knowledge and skill, but at a basic level, as I said, you know, my four-year-old can pretty much make a baked loaf himself already, and the rest of us sit somewhere in between those two extremes. So that's one part of it is helping people, you know, encouraging people baking, and the other part of it is the small independent bakeries, ideally within walking distance or cycling distance of people's homes. So
right.
We need more real bread bakeries in local communities. So how do we as an organization help that happen and support them? Part of it, a big part of what I do is about promotion. So Sourdough September, Real Bread Week, the two tent poles of our year, really, of just these people are baking all year round, but let's throw the spotlight on them, you know, twice a year, at least in particular. That's where, you know, if you do the same thing all year round, then you never get any press for it. But you know, so that's you do big showcases a couple of times a year.
Yeah.
But then more practically, what is there that we can do to support people? So part of it is helping facilitate people sharing knowledge and information, or in some cases just gathering that information in and then spreading it back out again. So many people have got so much knowledge and so many skills and have picked up useful things that are even beyond the baking, which are maybe more on the business side of things. But, you know, bakers, as you well know, very, very busy people working ridiculous hours, often at ridiculous hours.
Yeah.
Not necessarily got the need to share that information or the ability, the time or the brain space, you know, to do that. So here I am in my cushy office job that I have got that sort of, I am sure. Step back from that and say, right, okay, well, let me pick your brains. What have you learned that maybe someone else, the other side of the country, in some cases, the other side of the world might be in a similar situation and find that really, really useful. One of the key things we've done is a book back in 2011 called Need to Know, which was I inherited that when I came on as a volunteer for the plan for the campaign was to create a guide for 100 would-be bakers about how to set up a bakery business.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And by the time I'd finished writing it and getting all that information from, you know, I don't know, it's 50 odd bakers, I think I spoke to for that first edition. It was like, right, this isn't just some PDF charity, you know, third sector guide that we're going to let people download for free. There's an actual book's worth here. This is a, you know, a manual. So, you know, put that together back in 2011. And, you know, it sold thousands of copies. And over the last year or so, I've actually been, while everyone else was learning to bake sourdough, I was busy rewriting this book in my spare time. So we've got that coming out in November 2021 this year.
Oh, how cool.
It's called Need to Know More. It's about twice as long as the original book, 69,000 words. And it's primarily aimed at people who've got the hang of baking real bread, and people are telling them, hey, you could sell this. This is, you know, I'd pay for this. Or have decided they want a career change. And it's how to primarily set up a micro bakery in your own home.
Yeah.
And not so much a baking manual, it's a bakery manual. It's how do you start your own bakery business.
Totally get it. Oh, wow.
And all sort of bits and bobs that you might not have thought of, because there you were, sort of, you know, happily baking two loaves, five loaves at a weekend or whatever, and getting your scoring lovely, and you know, it all looks pretty and it tastes fantastic, and you can post it on Instagram and whatever, but then sort of start looking at the realities of, okay, if you're thinking of scaling up to the point where you can start selling it, what other things do you need to know about that? What's the legislation that you need to know? You know, what are the local food laws and the national laws and around marketing, and does someone need to come in and inspect your business? What do you need to do about your bank account? All the sort of the really dull stuff, not the sexy stuff that people got into bread making for in the first place, but sadly, all the essential stuff that you need to know.
Well, and those things that will keep you baking. that won't stop you in your tracks. Oh, that's so cool. I'm going to keep an eye out for that for sure. That's really interesting.
And the second part of the book is about people scaling up from that. Some people, you know, bake 20 loaves a week for the farmer's market or whatever, and that's, you know, great as a side hustle that they do at the weekends, you know, at the end of a hard working week. They then go and get up at 4 a.m. or whatever to bake for the farmer's market and then stand out in the freezing cold at the farmer's market. Crazy people, love them. But then some people go, no, actually, I want this to be my main job. You know, how do I now go from this position to maybe getting an industrial estate unit or maybe even a high street bakery? What do I need to do to then take the next step up to become the local community baker? So it's been great sort of chatting to people and sort of picking everybody's brains about what they've learned along the way and to try and then help share that, to try and help get more real bread out into our local communities and more local bakeries.
Absolutely. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Well, cool. I don't want to finish talking with you without talking more about Sourdough September and sort of the, like you said, that was one of the two sort of big campaigns sort of through the year that you do. And can you talk a bit more about what you've got planned for the month and what you're hoping that, maybe what you're hoping for and how folks can get involved.
So Sourdough September launched it in 2013. So this is its ninth annual international outing. And it's really about encouraging people to discover the delicious delights of sourdough, whether that's buying it from a local independent bakery and supporting those local bakers and getting a fantastic loaf, or about learning to bake at home, or more in many cases over the last couple of years, it's about people who got the bready baking bug during one of various lockdowns, to encourage them to keep going. Or in some cases, those ones who just shoved the starter to the back of the fridge, get it back out again. You know, come on, get back. It was you got into it. Let's get back into the swing of things. You know, Saturday morning or whatever, Friday night, get it out of the fridge, Saturday morning. Start making it, bake it Saturday night to eat on Sunday, whatever. So it's about celebrating genuine sourdough and the people behind its rise.
Yeah.
And we just want people to eat and enjoy more sourdough bread. And some people will then sort of, you know, once you've caught their attention, sort of talk a bit more about sourdough, what it is, what it isn't, and start looking at some of those potential health benefits. You know, beyond the it tastes delicious, and sort of dispel some myths, this sort of idea, you know, you get people saying, oh, sourdough, is that the same as soda? Which, because it kind of similar, can understand that from an outsider's point of view, say no, very much not. But yeah, the whole sort of message that we have of not all loaves are created equal, this one is fundamentally different.
Yeah.
Despite what the industrial loaf fabricators will tell you and say, oh, it's all flour, water, and salt. It's like, well, no, because your factory throws in, you know, a dozen or 20 different things, which perverts the course of this and turns it into something completely different in a very short space of time, whereas the long, slow lactic acid bacteria fermentation does amazing alchemy to it that it preserves and enhances some of the intrinsic values of the grain and the flour.
Yeah.
And then, you know, puts a little bow and a cherry on top, metaphorically. Makes the thing sing.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, you've inspired me to get my starter out of the back of the fridge as well. And get going. I've been spending my summer traveling up and down Vancouver Island here and stopping at all the bakeries, which has been amazing.
Fantastic. Wow.
But it's time to see if I still remember what I'm doing. So awesome. Well, thanks for that. And I'll make sure to link in the show notes, both to the Real Bread campaign and I saw your post sort of kicking off Sourdough September and all of that. So folks, if they want to get involved, they can join up.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. We'd love everyone to get involved, whether that's going and supporting a local bakery, baking a loaf at home, and out there on social media. I'd love to see the photos of people, especially photos of people with their loaves, not just the bread porn.
Yeah.
Just so we can see the faces behind the rise of Real Bread.
Thank you.
We love the hashtag We Are Real Bread and hashtag Sourdough Selfie, as well as hashtag Sourdough September.
Oh, love it. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, no, that and very, very good point. I would like to see more bakers alongside their bread and not just the bread, because
I mean, bread looks pretty, yep. and you know, I'm not saying that bakers don't, but bread looks pretty, but it's typically there's not a huge variety in loaves. You know, there are a lot of loaves that you see on especially on Instagram, basically. Someone's been reading Tartine, you know. But the bakers are unique. And we love to celebrate the fact that these are the people behind. This is what separates, one of the key things that separates real bread from an industrial loaf is there's not, you know, it's not a factory behind this and a computer behind it. It's this bloke, yes. This woman, this person.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Well said.
One of the key ingredients to good bread is a good baker.
Yes, absolutely. Cool. Well, thanks a bunch, Chris. It's been great to meet you and really good to talk with you.
Thank you. Lovely talking with you.
So cool. What a great chat. You know, right at the very end of the talk there, Chris talked about how bread after a while might start to look the same. Even really good bread might start to look the same, but bakers are unique. And so I just want to support what he was saying in terms of, let's put some bakers beside the bread in all those bread pics on social media, okay? Because you matter. Your bread's going to be savored and loved and shared between people. But, you know, let's talk about the bakers too. That's why we're here. Cool. Thanks, Chris, for coming on the show. Thank you for listening. I really enjoy bringing this podcast to you. So, you know, there are 145 episodes just sitting there at riseuppod.com waiting to be listened to. You can go through the entire back channel. I don't put a paywall up after 50 episodes or anything like that. It's all there for you. 3 years of talks. If you haven't had a chance, go check it out. Until next week, when we have a new talk with a new baker, work hard, bake lots, keep going, enjoy those fall markets. Happy baking. Bye-bye.